Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Sago. Episode 129 for August 4th, 2010. REAC. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show with free, libre, open-source software. We talk about it weekly. We talk about the projects that are interesting, the things that are interesting, the people that are interesting in the open-source community. I'm Randall Schwartz, your host, coming to you as often as I can, typically weekly. Occasionally, I skip one or another here. And also, I have a rotating panel of co-hosts that are all brilliant, all very cool people. This week, we bring back someone who you've heard here before, twice as a guest, I think, and a couple times now as a co-host, none other than my friend, Aaron Sego. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Randall. How's it going?
Going good so far. Going pretty good. Just trying to bring all my notes together again. I kind of missed last week, so it was kind of a little bit of a crazy experience there. And
at OSCON last week, I believe?
Yeah, I was at OSCON. No, it was 2 weeks ago. I was at OSCON, and we actually did a show from there. I don't know. Did you catch the show? And I can't remember what it was. Massive Open Stack. So I was at OSCON. Not only was at OSCON, I gave a small talk class there. And one of the hats I wear, of course, is for the Linux Fund. We had a party there. They did helped do some recruiting for a couple of organizations that donated pretty heavily to that. But I also was at Chris Marquardt's Street Safari. I got to do a lot of photography work out in the streets of San Francisco, so that was a lot of fun, too. Chris Marquardt, of course, appears on a lot of other Leo's shows. He's on the Tech Guy, and he does, like, a photography hour every once in a while with his stuff. But last week, what I was doing, the reason I missed is that Tuesday and Wednesday, when I normally tape this court or this show, I was teaching a full version of Learning Perl, my famous flagship book. I was actually teaching the course for that for a video that O'Reilly's going to be releasing pretty soon. So if you've wanted to see me teach and you haven't had a chance to come to one of the conferences I was at, you know, hey, now you're going to see me in video form. It's going to be on O'Reilly's video streaming site. So that'll be a lot of fun, too, because I know a lot of people have been looking forward to that. By the way, if you want to see my pictures that I shot there, if you go to flickr.com/Randall-Schwartz, so spell it all out, it's just like my normal name is normally spelled. Do you use some sort of photo hosting service, Aaron?
No, I don't. I don't know. I don't share with people. It's horrible. You'd think I would, but I just take pictures and I keep them to myself. Okay. I love when people do use Flickr, so maybe I should, because I'm always on Flickr looking at other people's photos.
There you go. Well, I mean, maybe I overshare. That could be part of the problem as well. I like to tell people I'm a recovering geek. So I'm sort of the social media, you know, butterfly somewhere in the middle of that. And speaking of social media butterflies and speaking of social media, show number 128, which was last week's, 2 weeks ago show. Well, there was a version up for about 2 days that was actually missing the entire closing. We apologize for that. If you got the show on the normal normal RSS feed, be sure to refresh it now, because you'll get another 5 minutes at the end of the show, the whole closing that I did with Simon Phipps on that. So please re-download that. Speaking of shows, did I even mention who today's guest was? I haven't yet, have I?
Not yet.
Oh, no.
We're all waiting with bated breath.
Well, let me introduce today's guests, and we'll go right to them then. Today's guests are Mark Phillips and Andy Gross. They work for a company named Basho, and what they produce is the a great NoSQL database. I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but if you've heard our shows on CouchDB and MongoDB, you know I'm sort of interested in this sort of stuff. REAC is a highly scalable data storage, data store. And that scales really well. I think that's like the number one feature. It's also really fault tolerant. Like, you can kick over one of the machines and just keeps working, and you can store anything you want. They're up to, you know, multi gigabyte files, and just manages to hold all that stuff for you, and lots of stuff there. So Mark and Andy are joining us from their offices, I think somewhere on the West Coast. Any last comments before we go to the guests there, Aaron?
No, I'm just interested to see how this all plays in with the transition from traditional SQL on out, and see exactly what this REAC is actually capable of doing.
So let's go ahead and get them on the line. Mark and Andy, I understand you're both on the same Skype connection. Say hello.
We are. Hey, guys, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
So which one's Mark? Which one's Andy?
That's there?
Mark with the hat here, Andy. So
that's with a different hat. You both have hats. Well, that's really complex there. Anyway, so hopefully our people at home can listen to a different tonality in your voices to pick out which one's which. That'll work fine. So I tried to explain. Now, I probably even mispronounced it. Ryak? How do you pronounce that first?
It's Ryak, chosen mainly because it's easily Googleable without a lot of collision with other projects. But it's also the Indonesian word for Ripple, which was the pre-open source predecessor of Ryak at Basho.
Okay, so give us like the 30,000 foot view, and then we'll keep circling in until we find some specific things that I can be really questioning about.
Sure. So I'm assuming you're aware of this NoSQL movement.
Yes.
It's sort of the hot new thing. You know, for the time being, we put ourselves in the NoSQL movement because that's where where the conferences happen, and that's where the discussion occurs. Although I think NoSQL is somewhat of a misnomer in that SQL isn't really the problem. The problem is making databases scale to multiple nodes using commodity machines for the type of apps that are becoming popular nowadays, which have a much more write-intensive profile, social apps. You know, in the past 10 years, you've seen, we've seen the shift from static web pages to web applications. And with that comes a change in the properties that you need to store, you need from your data store.
Well, the classic approach to this is with SQL tables, you end up with things like, say, a blog. You'd have to have the sort of the core person that the blog belongs to, but then you'd also have to go out to a separate table to query all the various blog entries, and that amount of joining and sending the right SQL down to do all that, that's what started being very expensive for some of these kinds of applications. Is that a good summary there?
That's what there is the issue with the data model. There's the need for scaling, and there's the data model. I've worked at companies that maintained your standard LAMP stack websites, whether it was MySQL or Postgres. And once you reach a certain level of popularity, once you reach a certain level of traffic, you end up having to denormalize your tables to the point where you're using it essentially as a key value store. Mm-hmm. So while in the theory, the way relational databases are supposed to be used is, normalize everything out as much as you can. In practice, at scale, people tend to normalize everything out and not end up using a lot of the features of SQL databases that, that are their primary justifications.
Okay, so one aspect of things like Ryak and other things in this area, like CouchDB and MongoDB, is that denormalization is sort of the norm rather than the exception. But from what I'm looking at in terms of the prep I was doing for the show, Ryak seems to be better at the other aspect of that, which is the scaling aspect of that. Why don't you describe why that's true and what features are actually in there to make that happen?
Sure, that's. We all have backgrounds in distributed systems. A lot of the company worked together at Akamai in the early days. So we learned a lot of things about scaling large systems, and we applied a lot of those principles to the development of Ryak. And while we do pride ourselves on our ability to scale down, we are scalable in the traditional sense that by adding another node to a Ryak cluster, you will experience an increase. The system as a whole experiences an increase in both throughput and storage capacity and compute capacity. There's several sort of subfamilies of NoSQL. The key value stores and document databases, which are kind of blurry as to what you call a document database, what you call a key value store. As far as a data model, there's the single server ones. CouchDB has replication, but it's essentially you have to configure replication in certain ways, and there's no automatic replication done by the system. MongoDB is somewhat the same way. They have some sharding capabilities. We're more in the family of projects like Cassandra and Voldemort, where they're based on the Dynamo paper. It's a paper published by Amazon, a highly, you know, influential paper in terms of how people are thinking about distributed infrastructures now. So with React, you simply point a node at a node in an existing cluster, and it will take on, you know, a fair share of that cluster's, you know, request, load, storage capacity, et cetera.
So in this system, though, why is replication so hard? And why is everyone trying to solve it like in overlapping but different ways?
Replication, we don't really think replication is hard. There's replication in the sense of, you know, replication across data centers, which we treat as a different thing, and people sometimes get confused between the two. We're talking mm-hmm. about when you write a piece of data to a cluster in general, guaranteeing that that piece of data is stored on a certain amount of servers. And the Dynamo paper and its use of consistent hashing allows any individual node to make a calculation as far as where a document should be written to or read from based strictly on local data. So it eliminates the need for any sort of master server that maintains mappings of document IDs to, you know, physical server locations. So a lot of the ease of replication in terms of both how we implemented it and how it works in operation flow naturally from the sort of fundamental distributed systems core that the React key value store sits on top of. And maybe a little later we'll get to how React is structured. And it's kind of a two-layered system where you have all the distributed systems fundamentals for things like group membership and management of cluster state separated out from, you know, this is the specific use case, the specific application. So we have sort of a very small key value application sitting on a larger sort of framework for writing distributed systems based on the Dynamo model.
Well, I definitely want to get to the architecture in a few minutes, but the one thing I keep tripping over as I'm studying these NoSQL databases and high availability and stuff is this notion of CAP that's sort of parallel to ACID in the traditional database sense. Can you maybe you can give me the first coherent explanation I've heard of CAP. Can you address that?
Sure. The CAP, or what's called the CAP theorem, it was originally proposed by Dr. Eric Brewer, who's actually a board member of Basho. C, A, and P stand for consistency, availability, and partition tolerance, respectively. He proposed, and it's since been proven by Nancy Lynch and Seth Gilbert, that a distributed system cannot at any moment in time be all three of consistent, meaning all nodes are guaranteed to have copies of the same data, available, meaning you can continue to, you know, it takes all requests, and partition tolerant, meaning if a node or a portion of the network splits from each other, if some of the nodes can't communicate, that's a network partition, and it's been proven that you can't have all three of those properties. So traditional databases sacrifice everything at the altar of consistency. You've probably seen a million times when a site gets reddited, PHP-based sites can't connect to MySQL server. Even if they're running a sharded environment, if you're trying to write data or log session data, databases that use transactions will not ever allow there to be two different versions of the same object in the database.
Right.
What React chooses instead is, by relaxing the consistency requirements, you can make a database that is both highly available and partition tolerant, which, you know, getting back to how applications are structured today, if you're writing an e-commerce app or, you know, if your money comes from serving data, even if it's slightly stale, it's often, you know, easy to justify sacrificing a little bit of consistency for availability. So in other words, if you know, you have two machines, you have a four machine cluster, and there's a net split between two machines such that two machines can talk to each other on one side and two machines on the other can talk to each other, but not among the not across the split. A traditional database wouldn't allow writes on either side because that would introduce the chance for inconsistent data to be served to clients. With REAC, it will accept writes, and by using a data structure called a vector clock, can later reconcile those writes together, sometimes automatically, also, if the client requests it, the client can request all differing versions, which typically only happen if there's a network partition or highly concurrent writes. And for a lot of data models, you can the application can resolve those conflicts. If you're adding things to a set like a shopping cart, you simply union all the objects in the conflicting versions and store it back. So it allows you, and all of this stuff is tunable on a per request basis. So with every request, you can say, you know, I want strict consistency, or I want, you know, any version of slightly relaxed consistency.
Let me try with a different example here, just so I can make sure I got my head around this. I'm thinking of a typical database problem would be like airline reservations, being able to put, you know, be able to sit in a particular seat on an airplane. It is like a travel lot, so I think about this problem a lot. So with something like traditional databases, you would never get a situation where seat 41A is both empty and full. I mean, it's either occupied or not occupied. But with something, say, if I wanted to build a reservation system using REAC, I could actually say that for the times when I absolutely need to know if that seat's empty or full, give me the absolute consistent version, wait and settle it out and give me the real thing. But for just simply seeing how many seats there are, I could get like a lighter weight version and say, just give me an approximate headcount in here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, they go to the first page. They may not go on to book a seat. So show them a version, and in your request say, you know, it can be slightly stale. And then at the moment where, and this is another great, the airline example is a good example, similar to the shopping cart example. At the moment where they actually need to reconcile it and know whether they sit on that seat or not, you can enforce stricter, quorum requirements on the request. And basically guarantee that there can't be another value.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. I think that it's, you know, because like like Slashdot, for example, if they're running Slashdot using something like REAC, the number of comments to a post could be a soft value. You know, if it's off by three, who cares, right?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be accurate. Yeah, it doesn't have to be up to the minute, but it will, you know, it will, you know, you can request it. And what we're seeing, this is really just a pattern of actual business needs being served by these parameters. So, you know, you incur less load and you become more available more often because you're able to choose in the airline example or in the comment counter example or even something like a profile image. You know, I think we're all used to setting some aspect of a profile on a social network site and it doesn't quite show up right away. You got to refresh the page. That's, you know, examples where, you know, up to the user level, they're okay with weaker consistency.
And I think it's worth noting as well, just to kind of wrap off this CAP discussion, that databases like REAC get a lot of flack for, you know, what people term as this lack of consistency. But, you know, eventually consistent, we're not talking hours here. We're talking, you know, in the low milliseconds, depending on how far apart, the request has to go. So it's really... It's a short period of time that things are eventually consistent.
That's cool. All this discussion of, you know, the traditional SQL approach and the traditional SQL model and then these new NoSQL things such as REAC, are you seeing people using the two models in conjunction in applications where they lean on a traditional, consistency-enforced SQL database backend on one side, and then for some of the content or some of the services, something more available, such as REAC?
Absolutely. Both, we think that there are many applications that are, you know, that can have a sort of hybrid or polyglot persistence is sort of the term people are using nowadays. We see that both with traditional SQL databases, whether it's a system that's truly a hybrid system or whether, you know, or during a migration off of SQL, it's very easy to sort of incrementally go to REAC. Even within NoSQL, you'll see people using a combination of NoSQL databases. Something we see a lot is React being used with Redis. Redis can provide really fast atomic counters, sets, and, you know, has a very rich data model. React being distributed can't do a lot of the things that Redis can do as fast. So you see people storing, you know, certain classes of data in Redis and some in React.
Absolutely. So at what point does that kind of complexity start to pay off? You talk about, you know, using, you know, even different NoSQL modules together, which is really cool that everything can work, you know, nicely together like that. Are you seeing a certain level of, you know, complexity in services where, you know, if it's below a certain threshold of complexity, it's, you know, do whatever you want, use the NoSQL, use SQL, it probably won't matter. Where does that, you find that layer, if there is one, of complexity, do you hit that where it actually starts to make sense to look at some of these more complex, you know, hybrid solutions?
If I understand your question properly, usually, the best case, the case that I like is people, React becomes sort of viral. People, it'll get introduced in the corner of the system, and people will get used to thinking in this sort of post-relational, distributed database model. And find reasons to move more architecture over to it. So a lot of times, React is just a natural fit for a lot of the applications, and so you have a mix at any given company of strictly React backed services, and some legacy or current SQL based services. As far as complexity goes, that's sort of on an app by app basis. We've been surprised with the number of use cases and the number of companies that you wouldn't think would consider NoSQL.
What kind of companies? Can you name some names? Give us some ideas of, you know, maybe some we've heard of, maybe some we haven't, that are using React in these kind of ways.
Sure.
Mozilla is a great user of ours. If you go out and Google and just Google React and Mozilla, you found a great blog post by their team over there. They're using it for their test pilot project. They have some pretty cool stuff going on with MapReduce, and they have two clusters running, one to store the data, and then they're actually pumping data into a second cluster to run analytics on. Comcast Interactive Media is a big user of ours. A company called Vibrant Media. There was a great post yesterday by a site called inagist.com about how they're using React. Company called Widescript, which is a great little startup out of Netherlands, I believe, is doing some great stuff with React and Node.js, actually.
We also just announced Wikia and Opscode as customers, and also Collecta, who's a real-time social media search engine. And there's some others that we can't talk about.
Of course. So because we all know big, you know, matters, can you give us an idea of, like, what's the biggest deployment in terms of either data or transactional quantity that you folks know of?
It's harder to – some customers either, you know, don't have any way to tell or are more tight-lipped about it. The one – unfortunately, I can't name the name of the company who has the biggest React cluster, but I think it's around 120 nodes the last I checked. I believe – I'm not going to make a guess about the data size because it's been a while since I've heard it, but, you know, terabytes and terabytes of data.
That's pretty impressive. Mark, you mentioned earlier that Mozilla was using the MapReduce functionality quite a bit. And I know from my SQL days way back when that, you know, for a few years I ate, breathed, and loved and, well, hated SQL. reading the React documentation the last few days, there's a lot of mention of MapReduce and as far as querying. Can you tell us a bit about how querying actually happens in React using MapReduce and perhaps how it compares to other solutions that are taking MapReduce along a similar path?
Sure. React's MapReduce is a query mechanism. It's not meant, at least right now, to be anything like Hadoop. Its primary function, or, you know, it's, you know, whereas Hadoop you'd use to crunch terabytes of log files to come up with some aggregate statistics, you know, in a MapReduce job that took, you know, an hour or so. React's MapReduce is meant to be over a smaller amount of data, you know, that's can fit in the, you know, request cycle of a web page. So actually providing data on a web page to an app. So it's shorter MapReduces. Although longer ones are possible, the original use case was for just a richer query mechanism than strictly key value, fast enough to be actually part of a web application. React is an excellent sort of place to store the output of a Hadoop job, so we see ourselves as very complementary with Hadoop. React lets you, we embed the SpiderMonkey JavaScript interpreter so that you can write, you don't have to know Erlang. React's written in Erlang, but for, you really don't need to know it. You can write your MapReduce functions in JavaScript, and one of the properties of all MapReduce implementations is that instead of moving a whole bunch of data around, we ship the functions to where the data it lives in the React cluster. So you get, you know, the parallelism you'd expect from a reasonable MapReduce implementation.
That all sounds really cool stuff. One of the things I was sort of curious about, and actually our chat room, we do have a live chat room while we're taping the show, and they've been bringing up the notion of, first off, what happens when a node goes down? Does it just wait for it to come back up, or does the data start shifting around, or I mean, how tolerant is it of something like that?
So I'll speak about the default React cluster. You can, you know, if you download the React source and type make devrel, it sets you up three, you know, self-contained React nodes that you can use to experiment with a local React cluster on your laptop. Mm-hmm. If you were to say, if given a three node cluster, you wrote the default replication factor is three. So every time you put a document, it will be stored on three nodes eventually. It's, the tunable request parameters let you say, I want to wait for one node or I want to wait for two nodes to respond before this request is considered successful. That's the sort of consistency trade-offs we were talking about before.
Sure.
So the typical way to set those is to set... So on reads, you get to specify how many replicas have to respond before the request is considered successful. That's what we call the R value. Mm-hmm. You said W is how many on write, how many replicas have to respond okay, you know, distinct replicas on different nodes have to respond okay before, you know, the client returns from the write call, before the write is considered successful. And then you have N, which is the number of nodes in the system. Mm-hmm. By setting R and W such that R plus W is greater than N. And I know this sounds kind of, I'm not trying to get too far into theory here, but it's really simple. What it basically means is that from the standpoint of a single client, since you're writing to a majority of nodes and reading from a majority of nodes, in other words, if N were three and you'd set R and W to two, you get what's called read-your-writes consistency, which is really just sort of the principle of least surprise when dealing with a data storage system. So back to what happens when a node goes down. Since you're issuing the requests with R and W values greater than N, or less than N, sorry, one node in the three-node cluster example, one node can go down and the request and a read request would still succeed since we've said, you know, store this on three nodes. A write request, what would happen is, since you can't store it on three nodes, you would store it on two, what we call a hint, meaning with the object, we store a hint saying where it was actually intended to go. And periodically, React will scan its database for the, scan its, you know, backing store for these hints, check to see if the node that it was originally destined for is alive, and hand them off back to it. Mm-hmm. Another way that it sort of maintains consistency, it does optimistic repair in that if say a node was down, you wrote foo to a to an object, or all three nodes are up, you write foo to an object, and one node goes down and you write bar to an object, and then you read the value. Two nodes are going to return bar, one node's going to return foo. through the use of the vector clock, which tracks sort of the ordering of events in the system, you'll be able to tell that the foo object is an ancestor of the existing object. It works in a similar way that source code control systems work, and discard it. So while we're servicing the read request, we notice that a node has out-of-date data and proactively repair it.
So in some senses, if you start out with three nodes and you take one of those away for a while and then manage to bring it back, it'll all just sort of keep working anyway, as long as you don't ever ask for three being for ROW then, right?
Right, right. And when you add a node, it the same logic, the same sort of very simple loop applies. What happens is an individual node will suddenly notice that it's not responsible for data that it has and try to hand it off to its rightful owner. And it's the same case as a node coming back online, adding a node.
Now, all that traffic is happening at a lower priority than the actual request coming in, right?
Yeah, the traffic is rate limited. There's a limit on the number of concurrent sort of connections for that type of data, and it doesn't typically interfere with the latency or throughput of the cluster as a whole.
So clearly, the data it sounds like that's auto magic, and I don't have to worry too much about that. Obviously, in real life, I have to worry a lot about it, but.
It really just works. As a user of the system, I mean, this is how this is sort of deep into the implementation. As a user of the system, you write data to it, you read data from it, and unless you're specifically asking for weaker consistency, the default values will not surprise you.
Okay. Now, what about a different axis for making sure you have availability? How would you back something like this up? Do you need to back up every single node entirely at a snapshot point, or how? How can I get a clean image of this on some offline media?
So it depends on the back end. React has pluggable back ends. It's a sort of an interface that you implement. You implement a certain number of functions, to put an item, to get an item, to fold over the entire list of items, to delete an item, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So there's currently back ends that are memory only, one that sits on, just uses the file system, one that uses embedded InnoDB, and one that uses, there's a bunch of community contributed ones, one that uses Redis. It's only a matter of time before someone puts MySQL behind it.
It's true.
Which isn't as crazy as it sounds. I mean, it's pretty good at storing stuff by primary key. I mean, but our preferred backend is something that Justin Sheehy and David Smith, who both work at Basho, wrote with the help of Eric Brewer, called Bitcask, which is a append-only file where basically it's a simplification of log structured merge trees, where you basically, database systems tend to have a commit log. This is basically Bitcask, which is the preferred backend, uses the commit log as the actual database itself. So you're not, it reduces a lot of the complexity and it's fast. It just appends to the end of the file. Periodically, files get merged, and once a file is closed, either due to the server restarting or the file reaching a certain threshold with regard to size or fragmentation, it's never touched again. So in the case of Bitcask, if you're using the defaults, regular file system backup tools will just work. In the case of InnoDB, it's a little more complex. There's a number of ways to back it up. There's a generic backup script for any backend that simply walks the entire data store. You can do it either a node at a time or from an entire cluster and writes everything out to a binary file.
Well, actually then, yeah, I guess if you just ask for all objects underneath a bucket, you're going to get everything eventually, right?
Yep.
So that's one way you can do a backup, do it softly through the actual interfaces.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you list the keys in a bucket. I mean, there's a slightly more efficient operation that's not really exposed at the client level. So instead of waiting for the entire list of keys, you can simply pass it a function that's applied to on the back end to every single item, which is a fold operation, basically.
Okay. And before I get way too deep in this stuff, I'm sure there's about a third of our audience that their eyes are slightly glazed over at this point. So I do want to talk about this also as an open source project, because that's the other point of this show. So what's the history of the project? Why is it open source? What kind of license is under the that sort of thing? You want to go ahead and take that?
Yeah, so React is licensed under Apache 2. Mm-hmm. the story, we could do an entire show on the store if you wanted to, but Basho was founded to build sales applications. And the founder recruited this fantastic team of distributed systems engineers, and they built this database to, you know, to be the data store for this sales application. And at some point we said, you know, listen, this is much better than what we could do with the sales app. The market's looking more like it's ready for a database. Why don't we just, you know, stick to our laurels and open source it. So that's what we did. So It was actually August.
The best we can determine from source control archaeology is around August 7th or August 9th. So almost a year ago now. And so, I mean, the first version of React I wrote on the plane over to my interview with Basho. That turned into... just right after I read the Dynamo paper, super, super jazzed on it. That was followed by about three internal versions of what is now React. And then, you know, after those, this is typical, you know, software that backs a service written in house, nobody's ever going to see it. So I wouldn't call it a rewrite, but, last August we polished it up for open source, released it under the Apache 2 license. We're coming up on 1 year of open source, but, in December it'll be 3 years since the actual beginning of React.
Cool. And so what's the community size in terms of people making commits to it, and how does that process work?
We actually have, I'll let Mark handle this. Mark's our community manager, but I just looked at the thanks file every time someone sends us documentation or code fixes. Looked at the thanks file. I think we're over 30 different committers that have committed, something of significance to React. So that's 30 people who've actually, you know, dove into the code and docs and wanted to commit. But Mark can speak to
From pure numbers standpoint, I think on the mailing list as of this morning, we had, you know, just over 400 people. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to see more of the contributions in like the client libraries. Erlang is a bit of a complex beast. So, you know, getting deep into the distributed systems code is something that you don't really see that much. But I guess, you know, we do have a good amount of contributors on that.
You'd be surprised. I mean, I learned Erlang in 2 weeks, and we've had customers that, you know, are, you know, Java programmers that, you know, about a month after they started playing with React, they were asking us questions and sending us patches for some of the most complex distributed systems code. So Erlang has a confusing syntax, but... we've found, you know, I think we've converted a lot of people to at least changing their opinion, if not, you know, learning Erlang as a result of them checking out React. But we do try to make it, a black box so that you don't have to know any Erlang to use it.
I was just noticing that even like the MapReduce functions can be written in JSON. You don't have to know Erlang for all that, right?
Exactly.
Cool. So. I mean, it's not that I don't want to learn Erlang. It's just I already have this long list of things I'm still trying to learn.
Yeah, so. Erlang isn't always number one on people's, programming languages to learn with. So, you know, one high-level goal is to make it as much of a black box as possible. And the question is somewhat, Oracle's written in C++, and you don't have to know C++ to use Oracle. So I'm not, people get over the implementation language thing pretty quickly.
If you don't have to like C++, actually. You can still use it.
I think we've probably seen outside of the Erlang community, we've probably seen the biggest uptake from people in Ruby and people in JavaScript. And actually, the thing that really brought the Ruby guys in was we hired a great guy named Sean Cribbs, who wrote Radiant CMS. And we had a client who really wanted this top-notch Ruby interface to React. So we kind of brought Sean on, I think it was contract work initially, and then he worked with this client. They open sourced the driver after he was done with it, and it just exploded from there. So that driver is called Ripple, which is coincidentally the name of an earlier iteration of React. JavaScript and Ruby are really where we're starting to hit our stride.
And so the interface to this, then, I know it's mentioned that it's RESTful. So is this basically everything is text mode, calls over HTTP protocol then?
It's all HTTP. The first thing Basho actually open sourced is a HTTP library called WebMachine, which basically turns the flow chart that is, you know, full HTTP 1.1, it's pretty complicated, into a state machine. And users can simply write callback functions in their resource, and it abstracts over all the what error code to return, how to parse the headers, what to put in the return headers. So our HTTP interface is implemented on top of Web Machine, which mm-hmm. is nice for a lot of companies who already have, you know, an HTTP-based service infrastructure. You can put a Squid or Varnish HTTP cache in front of React. It works with, you know, all caches and proxies. So it's very naturally fits into architectures like that. We also have the disadvantage of HTTP is that it's a verbose protocol. It's a string-based, protocol. Mm-hmm. That has some overhead in terms of both its verbosity and the rich semantics of it. So we also have a binary protocol based on Google's protocol buffers that you can speak. And there are, I don't think we have a protocol buffers client for every single language for which we have an HTTP client yet, but we're getting there. So if you want, if you don't need the richness of HTTP or you just need to load data fast, you can use the protocol buffers client, and you can use either one. You can mix them. You can write data with protocol buffers and retrieve it with HTTP and vice versa.
Is there any kind of authentication built in front of that then, or do I need to hide this behind like an Apache proxy or something to control that, or is it all by firewall?
We don't have any built-in authentication. We have bigger plans in the future for solving the authentication problem, and HTTP basic auth it still wouldn't let you expose it to a browser. Right. So we think the best, our decision was the best thing to do was let the user decide. If they may already be, they're likely already using some sort of web server or proxy like Nginx or Apache that, and probably already have an existing authentication system. So you can, we leave that up to the user.
So you're counting on something in front of this to take care of that then?
Yeah.
Okay. As I'm writing to this, because it's REST, I can, I can grab the Perl LWP library and create queries in a few minutes. Is there anything in a Perl library that it'd want beyond that, or is that all that's really necessary?
With any language, the reason we focused on HTTP first was that any language, every language has a HTTP library. You can just use LWP, although there are Perl libraries available, and there's a link, links to them on our wiki. Everything's available through the HTTP interface, from simple get and put and delete operations to MapReduce and link walking, which is another sort of unique aspect of our query model that lets you define arbitrary relations between objects and with HTTP syntax sort of walk that that tree of associations.
And if you
tends to be the next step is to try to figure out then, if I have some sort of, not just document store, but I have like documents that need to link to other documents, how do I do that server side so I'm not constantly sending more and more queries across, right?
So you could say, documents, you can, via the REST interface, you can add the, with headers or with, in the body of your JSON document, specify links, which are a three tuple of bucket, key, and tag. So a very simple example would be you have a manager bucket with keys that are the email addresses of the managers. You have an employee bucket with keys that are the email addresses of the employees. And for each object in the manager bucket, there you can have a link or a set of links to employees, and you can tag those links with either, you know, with their relation. So it could be, you know, reports to, this is my boss. And you can even tag the inverse way. So with tags set up like that, you can issue an HTTP query that essentially says /managers/employees/_ for leave, you know, you want all the employees. So with HTTP syntax, you can actually construct an HTTP path that represents the traversal path you want to take across the objects and return the result.
Well, this is obviously a fairly sophisticated and complicated, you know, product. It's free software, open source software, which is really great. But there's the company behind it, Basho. And, you know, I've been listening to this, and as I've listened to you go on and on about, you know, really the level of technology that's in it, the complexity of it, I keep thinking, okay, so what's the motivation for Basho? How is Basho, what's the business model here? Is it a open core solution with premium content? Is Basho creating solutions around it for clients? How does that fit into the business model with the free software side of it?
So Basho, it's essentially an open core model. We have software that is React. There's nothing. From a source standpoint, the version of React in the enterprise, the open core editions, is the same as the open source version. We don't cripple it in any way. It's the exact same thing. And innovation tends to flow both ways. A lot of our customers become contributors, and a lot of the work that goes on in some of the add-ons for React reveal efficiencies and techniques that we can apply to open source. The current add-ons, and these are all applications that use the publicly available sort of extension points of React to add additional functionality. The current add-ons are SNMP and JMX monitoring, a web UI, and cluster-to-cluster, this is long-haul data center replication. So these are things that won't stop your developer from starting to use it. We have there's a lot of companies that use it in production, just the open source version. But we have the enterprise features that tend to be things that usually larger scale deployments want.
And so you folks are selling these add-on enterprise level deployments or add-ons on top of React. Is that the idea of how it works?
Exactly. Right. And okay. And we also sell, you know, support and consulting and you know.
Yeah. So support's kind of an interesting thing because we our director of product and services we brought on, I think, 3 months ago. His name is John Hornbeck, and he hired. Basically, we have developers doing support. So and we take a proactive approach to it, and you know, because we have an enterprise version where we charge for, you know, a few pullbacks, we get to open source a lot more, basically right into the community, so that we are able to spend time supporting the open source community and not, you know, letting a question go on the mailing list and you know, attempting to get that person or that installation as an enterprise customer. So that's kind of the stance we take.
Yeah, and the enterprise stuff is all built on extension points on React, like I said. And our general goal or what we want to do is gradually, as version one of some enterprise feature, enterprise add-on is nearing its, you know, or we're working on version two. We'll release version one in open source, and some of the things are complex too that we don't necessarily want to that will take more time to since these are people trying to do it on ourselves, not with a support contract, that would take more time to integrate and make general enough for open source use. And I don't mean that as a cop out. I mean that, you know, there's a quality bar to open source,
I think that's sensible. Yeah. And it makes sense. Are these policies that you're talking about stated on or your website or part of the corporate policy, in particular the ideas of, you know, the core REOC that's open source remains the same as the what you're using for the enterprise, or when you talked about version 2, you know, comes along of an add-on, you open source version 1. Are these kind of decisions that you make as you go, or is there an actual stated policy that people that are either looking to adopt REOC or looking to work with you can reference?
We don't have a stated policy, and maybe we should at least enumerate some of these guiding principles. We tend to just, you know, put the most value in the open source product as we can, and you know, make a sensible plan for, you know, if we feel that we try to look at it from the user's point of view, and if we feel that you know, it's time to accelerate moving some of the open source or some of the enterprise holdbacks into open source, we will. And if someone went out and made in the community, went out and made an equivalent piece of functionality to something that was in open source, and we would take an honest look at it. And if it was something that was getting adoption in the community versus the version that we had, someone just came in the room. Versus the version that we had, we might consider, you know, taking that on and putting it in open source and supporting that. And, you know, it's on us to innovate.
Well, it sounds like you guys have a pretty good head on your shoulders about how to divvy that up. And I know that it's always the issue of, you know, I really want to contribute something that's a community effort and make it possible for everybody to just download something and use it, make it useful. But at some point, you got to pay the bills. And that's a really good thing. That sounds like you've got a pretty good balance on that. Speaking of that, where can people go to find out more about this wonderful product we've been talking about for the last hour?
So I don't know if you can see it on the whiteboard, but the company's Basho. Go to www.basho.com. That's our corporate website. Anything you want to know about REOC is going to be on wiki.basho.com. And we're all on Twitter. So if you go to twitter.com/basho/team, that's everybody that works at Basho. And you can follow that list and sort of tune into what's going on.
Yeah, and if you're looking for just the quickest and most robust introduction to REOC, there's this thing on the wiki called the Fast Track, which is something we put together to get people from zero REOC knowledge to, you know, basically running MapReduce queries in about 45 minutes. So it'll take you through, you know, what it is, how to set it up on your local machine, you know, how the distribution works, what the, you know, what a node is, how it hands off data, things like that, and then actually put some data in and run some MapReduce queries. And then people seem to love that.
And then 5 minutes later, you're running a blog with it, right? Because everybody puts
exactly.
a blog.
Then you're in production and
Cool. Well, it sounds like some, again, I, for some reason, I'm fascinated with these NoSQL databases. I think it's because in recent months, I've had to just deal with SQL, and I just keep bashing my head against ORMs and go, oh, there's got to be a simpler way to do the replication. And we didn't even get into, and I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, but we didn't get into the whole idea that there's no master slave really here. You know, that it's really just any one of the nodes can go down, and it just seems to work. Actually, you want to take 30 seconds and explain
that?
Yeah,
actually, REOC, one of the things is it's a fundamentally decentralized system, meaning that no node is special. There's no master node. There's no node that if it goes down, the rest of the system suffers. It'll compensate, you know, within reason. You can lose a minority of your nodes and still function. And it's decentralized in that way. And that also, you know, so that has advantages for the fault tolerance of the system, but also for operations. There's no sort of special server you got to dance around when you're upgrading things or dealing with, you know, as a sysadmin or as an operator of a machine. You don't have to sort of dance around some special node. That so you get savings both in, you know, less downtime and in sort of cost of operations.
And on a comical note, we actually put a video up on our blog about a week ago. It's called Consistent Smashing, and it kind of pokes a little bit of fun at different replication models, and it's a very unscientific approach to what we just talked about, but it'll give you a good laugh if you're into database stuff.
Well, I really want to thank you guys for stopping by today and telling us all about REOC, and it looks like I'm going to be looking into that. In fact, my current client may actually need something almost exactly like this, so we'll see. Maybe this is fortunate in timing, actually.
Yeah, let us know.
Can we expect you to contribute to the Perl driver?
If I use it, definitely we need to start doing something. I'm definitely going to be contributing back. That's my whole game too. So absolutely. Because it would be from Perl. This project here is all in Perl. So that's what Corbett was asking about it earlier as well. So again, I want to thank you guys for stopping by. This is Mark Phillips, who is the, the community manager. And Andy Gross is the VP of engineering. Lots of cool titles up for you there. Thanks for stopping by, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you too, Aaron.
Bye.
So that was Mark and Andy talking about React. That was fascinating, huh, Andy? Aaron, sorry.
We both begin with letter A. It's all the same thing, really, at the end of the day. Yeah, it is. It's really, I think, interesting to see how the scalability of the internet and the demands that are being put on it now have just pushed people, you know, really to the limit of what they're capable of doing. And we're seeing all of these really new and interesting ideas. I thought it was interesting how he said, you know, he was just reading a paper on, you know, how to deal with, you know, highly distributed systems for data. And then he gets, you know, picked up by this company to actually work on these things. It's a really cool, exciting, fast-moving area of computer science. And what I think is awesome, free software is right at the leading edge of it. So. Very cool.
Absolutely. I don't know a real major site that, well, I'm probably biased, but I don't know a major site really that doesn't all mostly or all free software top to bottom now, because there's just so much available that does so many of the different pieces of it.
Yeah, the whole cross-pollination between, you know, Google being able to say, hey, we've got this great idea, you know, here's how we're doing it. They write papers and, you know, other companies come out and go, hey, we've got a great idea too. The collaboration that we're seeing is allowing, you know, all these, you know, really it's the promise of open source, right? You have all these different companies that have a similar need, and not just companies as well, but also, you know, volunteers or whatever, coming together with common need and finding solutions together and developing new science in the process, which is, I mean, that's exactly what everyone said. This is what free software open source can do. And here it is doing it, delivering results.
And not only a collaboration across the axis of, say, businesses and stuff, but actually like education, researchers can be contributing to this back and forth. They can build on what a business has done to solve their own business need and then build research on that to even make it better.
Yeah, it almost sounds too good to be true, but it's actually working. That's no, and it is. It's kind of those things that if, you know, I think back 15 years and if I told someone that, you know, in the industry, they'd look at me and go, yeah, you're some sort of weird idealist and, yeah, that'll happen. When? Never. And yeah, it's great. And the products we're seeing, like React, I mean, it's some very impressive stuff. I've been trolling through their website and poking at it for the last few days, and it's a really interesting product, and not a trivial thrown together in an afternoon kind of hack. It's really solid work.
Yeah, and on top of that, you just mentioned this a moment ago, but it dawns on me now that, you know, back when I was starting with, you know, my little Perl CGI scripts in 1994, where, you know, it's okay if you forked every time you had a hit come in, and you could even connect to the database and disconnect from the database on every hit that came in. And for a small site, for a small shopping cart or something where you might get 3 or 4 transactions a second, that all worked just fine. And then along comes the entire rest of the internet and the rest of the users out there, and not just millions, but billions of internet users now that, you know, you make a popular site like Twitter, and you've really got to figure out how to scale and scale well. And Twitter is not a business model yet, but I mean, like for something that like Amazon has to figure out how to scale really well. And they've helped contribute to this research as well.
And what's crazy, I think, about it is that, you know, you capture it really well. It's not something that people sat back and went, you know what would be really great? Let's have billions of users. It just happened. And it happened while people were using technologies that were good enough and then suddenly weren't good enough. And so the solutions have had to come about as fast, or hopefully a little bit faster now, than the growth and the success of these services. And that's a real challenge. And I think it's very telling that we're not seeing it's not dominated by proprietary software. It's dominated by open software that's developed collaboratively with researchers, with companies, with people that are, you know, extra company as well. And that's, I think, part of the key. I don't know if we could actually get these kind of solutions emerging quickly enough and into the hands of the people that need it right now quickly enough under a different model.
Can you imagine what that would have to be then? It'd be like you'd burn VC money. You have a business proposal, burn VC money to create from scratch everything like what Apache is, and then everything like what React would be all from scratch every time. There's not VC money to burn to do that. It doesn't work that way.
And there's not time. You spend, you know, a year or two in quiet R&D, and then you start doing your marketing and your promotion, and you try and get people convinced, and you get one or two key clients, and, you know, the time, I think even if there was the money to burn, you're right, there isn't. I think the time to market on these things where people need these solutions now, and so they need to be able to get in and add, you know, the parts they need now and not wait for some company to mind read what they need and produce, you know, products for the market. I think the timing issue for at least internet services has become as critical or even more critical than the actual question of can you fund it.
Very cool. Very cool. Yay, open source. That's really the bottom line. You know, it seems to be
Absolutely.
Working for a lot of people. And it's the reason I'm giving this show every week, to be able to talk to people about all the cool things that are going on. And I just keep stumbling across this great stuff. Again, this was another project that was brought to me by people that wanted this project to be on. And the project leaders wrote me. That's how a lot of people get on, including some of our upcoming guests. Let me run through the list real quick here. We have next week, we have Andy Hall and Akeem Hassan-Mueller. They're going to talk to us about VirtualBox, which is originally a Sun project, now I guess all under the Snorkel label. No, Oracle, I mean, not Snorkel, but, you know, Sun Oracle, right? All put together. And Aaron Newcomb's coming back to co-host that show, and he knows a little bit about Sun, having worked there for a while. Stephen Heminger is going to talk to us about Vyatta, which is a Cisco clone. So you can take a standard Cisco box and keep the same interface and everything, but it's all open source from top to bottom, running the compatible operating system. Dan Scott, Mike Rylander are going to talk to us about the Evergreen Open Library System used by hundreds of libraries all around the U.S., at least maybe around the world. And then just recently added to the schedule, Thomas Cherryholmes of Linux MCE. This is the home automation, home media player, home... intruder system, alarm system, everything. And I've got a special co-host for that. We've got Scott Wilkinson coming in. He normally hosts the Twitch show on home theater. And so he's going to come in and help me ask intelligent questions about home media players, of which I don't have any since I'm always on the road. So a lot of great guests coming up. Come look at twit.tv/floss to be able to get the future guest list. If you want someone on the list that isn't there, have just email the project leader. Other project leader, email me. My address is all over that. So you can find Merlin at stonehenge.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N. Make sure you get the Y in there. You also get some guy from Disney. And if you follow me on Twitter, you'll also find out that I'm also I'm checking in on Foursquare everywhere and checking in on Yelp. And I'm now like the Duke of a lot of places on Yelp, and I'm the mayor of a lot of places on Foursquare. Aaron, have you gotten into that at all? Or is that something that you just don't want to touch?
I haven't. I don't know. I feel old and, yes, somehow behind the times. I'm on Identica, which is the free software version of Twitter. You can find me there under ASIGO, A-S-I-G-O, and, of course, my blog. But other than that, I'm a little bit of a hick when it comes to these awesome new services online.
Well, I tell you, it's really weird. For some reason, I like points even if they don't mean anything. So, like, I want to have the points of having checked in, even though it means absolutely nothing. I'm playing Wii Rule, and I'm up to like level 35 in Wii Rule. I'm Randall Schwartz in Wii Rule, and again, I'm playing it, but there's no real point to it except it's now just annoying me. So I don't know why I'm just addicted.
Artificial scarcity is an amazing thing.
It could be. It could be that. So that's great. I'm also going to be at Dragon Con in a few weeks. That's getting on my one indulgence conference for the year. You know, I go to enough conferences for work. You probably do too as well, Aaron, right?
Yeah, I hit a few every year, they say.
Yeah. And so I'm going, and Dragon Con's the one place where I just get to play around a little bit. I'm on the EFF track there. So if you're in the Atlanta area in a few weeks from now, I think they still have a few open slots that people can get in. But the conference is like 30,000 people, so it's really huge.
Wow, it's huge. Massive. Great.
All right. Any last words for our audience, Aaron?
No, just thinking that I'm actually at a slightly smaller conference in 2 weeks, actually, myself, out in Ottawa, the FOSS-LC meeting out there. So if anyone's in Ottawa, it's going to be slightly smaller than 30,000 people, but it should prove to be fun.
There'll be fewer people dressed in Princess Leia slave costumes, very likely, right?
I'm hoping not, but probably.
Well, I don't know. Have you seen... I'm not even going to go there. That would just be sad. Let's just say there's a lot of large costumes. A lot of costumes mixed to large size at Dragon Con for various reasons. So, okay. Well, I've probably wasted enough of our audience's time. So I'm going to say what I always say. We'll see you again next time on Floss Weekly.